In part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of cheeses, 25 kinds of olives, and 100 kinds of olive oil. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. This afternoon, we're going to take a look at war through the eyes of an anthropologist. Our guest is Carolyn Nordstrom, an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Notre Dame. She is the author of Shadows of War, Violence, Power, and International Profiteering in the 21st Century. Citing the famous Chinese military expert Sun Tzu, Nordstrom says it is important to understand war, why, in her words, humans will or will not point a weapon at another and pull the trigger in the pursuit of politics. Warfare, said Sun Tzu, is the greatest affair of state, the basis of life and death, the way to survival or extinction. It must be thoroughly pondered and analyzed. Perhaps as many as 200 million lives were claimed in war and political violence in the 20th century. And Nordstrom says today one-third of the world's countries are engaged in some form of political violence. But she says, quoting again, such numbers tell us little about how war is lived, felt, and died. What words, she asks, carry a soldier into battle, sustain a 14-year-old bearing an assault rifle, evaporate as a mother falls dead at the front, are cried by her family in watching her die? This afternoon, we'll talk with Carolyn Nordstrom about what she has learned about what she calls the shadows of war. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. In addition to Shadows of War, Professor Nordstrom is the author of A Different Kind of War Story. She is also co-editor of Fieldwork Under Fire and The Paths to Domination, Resistance, and Terror. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Nordstrom, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Would you give us some sense here at the outset of what you're talking about when you talk about shadows of war?
I realized that working on the front lines of wars, really out there where the worst of violence takes place, it tends to be a place where we don't really have researchers, we don't really have many media crews, and in a sense, much of what takes place in warfare isn't really visible to the larger public eye. So you have everything from human rights abuses to acts of tremendous courage and altruism to really, really dangerous profiteering. And most of this goes unnoticed, uncommented upon, because it's just too far from the light of media and analysis and people's conversation.
Yeah. It also seems, though, that you cite another scholar, we have an interest in denial.
You know, actually, it's great. I love your introduction, by the way. Thank you. You've picked my favorite quotes, and you're picking some of my favorite topics. It's interesting because I've done this now for 20 years, and I find that the average person really finds it extremely disconcerting to deal with true atrocity. And right now, for example, in the world today, everywhere in the world, if you just add up all the world's wars, more children are killed than soldiers. Now, this is a horrifying statistic. We've lost something very important in our sense of humanity when this is the reality, yet it's very hard for people to wake up, have a cup of coffee, eat their Wheaties, get ready for work, and ponder this. It's almost easier to push it away.
I wonder if we need to. We need to look at it, certainly, but also we can't be confronted with it every moment. You know, and people have written about compassion fatigue, and
I actually happen to totally agree with you. And it's funny because I have a model I don't think a lot of people use, but I was actually trained as a medical anthropologist. I went to medical school as well as getting a degree in anthropology. And I was doing this when I first got caught in severe political violence 20 years ago, which started my new studies. And I use a medical approach. I just oftentimes, when I'm very confused about how to handle something, I think of, well, what would a doctor in an emergency room do? And I think it's the same thing. You know, you walk into an emergency room, or you're a nurse, or you're an orderly, or even your mother or father gets sick and you're in the hospital, and you're surrounded by really severe suffering, and yet there's that sense that I can do something to make a difference, and yet I have to get my life, you know, going along its normal track as well. So we actually in our everyday life learn ways of dealing with tragedy, and I think we can use those to apply to larger war. You're right, we can't deal with it 24 hours a day. But we can take an hour a week to maybe write a letter to the editor or talk to friends and say, you know, something's got to change.
Yeah. You open the book with the story of a friend who, after attending some religious festivities with you in Sri Lanka, set out to return to her home in Colombo. And when she got there, the city was in flames. It was 1983. What would you like to tell our audience, our listeners, about her story?
The story has stuck with me for 20 years. She was a wonderful, middle-aged, happy, loving mother, one of the great friends that we all know and love in our lives. You know, glasses that sort of sat askance on her nose, and the hair that always looked really pretty, but something was slightly out of place because she's always hugging kids and packing lunches. And she, when we parted ways, she bought a watermelon. And it was just a big old fat watermelon she was so excited to take back to her kids. So she was juggling her handbag, her suitcase, and this watermelon, not knowing that this horrible, explosive set of riots was going to break out. So when she arrives to her home city, and it's absolutely besieged with mobs, people killing people, setting things on fire, beating innocent people, she begins to try to find her way home. She's dumped by the bus driver in an unknown neighborhood. He just panics and flees and dumps the bus, so she doesn't even know where she is. And as she's walking along, she sets down her purse, thinking, well, I'll come back tomorrow and get it because it's too heavy. She's covered with soot, and mobs are running by, and she's watching people beaten. And a little bit later, she sets down her suitcase, and she says, well, I'll pick this up tomorrow. Of course, not even thinking. And she trudges mile upon mile, clutching a watermelon. And we talked about that later, and we thought, you know, for her, these riots were people of one ethnic group killing people of another ethnic group. And they were killing each other over goods, commodities, power. And for her, everything in her handbag probably represented her identity, you know, what side she was supposed to affiliate with, you know, who she voted for, where she lived, the kinds of goods that she had, the kinds of commodities she liked. But for her, that watermelon was innocence. It was hope. It was good. So she leaves everything and arrives home with nothing but a watermelon for her family, which ultimately was a beautiful thing in a curious way. And it taught me a lot about what people hold on to in severe violence.
Yeah, this, though, raises an interesting question. When you're in the field, are the stories people tell about their experience in war sometimes difficult to interpret, to decipher?
You have done this kind of research. I'm convinced of this because you're asking questions that are difficult and yet very central. People often talk on two levels. If they feel safe, they open their hearts to you because they want to speak of their realities. To not speak of what they've seen and felt and gone through is somehow not to give voice. It's important for people to speak to the atrocities they've endured. But if they don't feel safe, they often tell you in a story. You know, they'll often speak about things like carrying a watermelon or telling you a folk tale because they're fearful that, of course, people are killed for taking sides in wars. So, yeah, they do speak in riddles and they do speak in parables. And I have some of these in my book where, you know, the effort to begin to try to translate what it is that people are trying to tell you.
Yeah, you have to spend the time and you have to listen very carefully.
One of my favorite stories. Do you have a moment for a good story?
Sure.
I was up in, this is in Mozambique, years and years after the example we've been talking about. This is over in Africa. And it was one of the worst wars. It was called the Killing Fields of Africa. A million people had been killed in this war. One out of every 12 people. Astounding level of destruction. And I was up on the front lines, and there was this little hotel. Well, there aren't any hotels on the front lines. Why was this hotel there? You know, everything is bombed out. And yet it was functioning. And people began to tell me that one of the major leaders of Africa would fly in at night and stay in the hotel. And every time he would leave something. He would leave an umbrella, or he would leave his hat, or he would leave his shoes. And I thought, what are these people? I know they're telling me something, because they kept telling me these stories. Well, it took me 6 months to piece it together. And what it was, they were talking about arms transfers. They were telling me who the major people were supporting this one side. And, of course, an umbrella was assault rifles. His hat was, you know, landmines. Supplies were shoes. And the hotel hadn't been bombed, because it was a supply depot. So it does take some work to figure these stories out.
But on the horrific side here, these people are speaking in code to you so as to protect themselves.
Absolutely. Because people can get killed for talking in situations like this.
Yeah. One of the stories I was drawn to in the book, there are many, many stories in this book that are worth our time. The story that you open, Making Things Invisible, Chapter 3, Invisible Profiteers, and you open with the story of a Mozambican soldier, talking with you about shapeshifters.
Yeah.
And he tells you, you know, of course, people say only we Africans practice such things. We only see shapeshifters. But then he goes on to explain to you what he is talking about. And it gets to the idea of invisibility, and it gets us back to the idea of investigating the shadows. What would you like to say about the shapeshifter that this soldier told you about, and how does a shapeshifter make himself invisible?
Great question. And again, one of my favorite stories. In African mythology, it's in many places on Earth, when things are very, very difficult, people often turn to sort of mythological explanations. So there's a sense that I think we can almost understand that with, say, some of our own troops holding very dearly in Iraq to a belief in the protection by saints, you know, to miracles. And in terrible times, people need these things. And, of course, in Africa, this is very well developed. So there is that sense that people actually can survive a war zone by literally shifting their shape so that they, for example, don't get hit by a bullet, so that they can move across enemy lines. But, of course, what this man was trying to draw out was this marvelous example that, in fact, what you really need to look out for are two things. People shift also on a personality level. Those who you think you can trust may be working for the other side.
Mm.
Those who seem to be doing some kind of work may, in fact, be doing something very different. And then what he was speaking to, again, on a third level, is an even bigger story, that those people that we don't really know what they're doing may be engaged in tremendous profiteering. And he would tell me stories of people who, for example, would supply one side by day and then supply the rebel side by night. People who would kidnap civilians and hold them for ransom in the midst of war to profiteer on the war. Multinational corporations who flew arms for both sides. And he said, you know, you'll listen to newscasts and, you know, for example, one group of industries in the world will say, well, you know, we obviously believe in the side of the war. And what nobody's documented is while they say that publicly, in the shadows, they're selling arms to all sides and making quite a bit of money on it. So that's what he meant by the shapeshifters, that sense of you really have to watch clearly because people aren't always who they say they are.
Yeah. Well, there's another story later in the book about diamonds.
Yeah.
And you tell a story about how two soldiers fighting on the same side who are commanders of their posts, and they're at mining sites.
Yes.
So on the same side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of these guys makes a deal with somebody from the other side. He calls him up.
Side.
Yeah, and says, tell you what, you know.
Mm-hmm. You attack my friend.
Yeah.
And we'll split the diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually makes a deal with the enemy to defeat his friend so that they can get the diamonds. Mm-hmm. And that's the classic shapeshifters. And, you know, these things are really nothing is really taking place just on a national level anymore because these diamonds are moving worldwide. So if you're walking on the front lines, you're not only seeing soldiers doing these kinds of things, you're seeing people from all over the world, the diamond brokers, the middlemen, you know, the pilots that are ferrying it out, you know, the people who are weighing the diamonds and shipping money and bringing them up to Antwerp. So it's a very complex international cast of characters involved in all of this.
And they go from place to place.
And they go from place to place. Yeah, I see the same people all over the world.
Do you talk with these people?
Oh, yeah. That's one thing. The one thing that I think most surprises people is how much people will tell me. And at first I think I just sort of took it, you know, well, that's natural. You know, you're out there, people talk. And then I realized when I come back home and some people say, well, why would people tell you they're, you know, running diamonds and smuggling arms? And as I began to study it, and I realized that almost everyone gets up in the morning and says, good morning, I'm a good person. It's a good day. I feel good. They don't get up in the morning and say, I'm a really terrible, sleazy smuggler. And because they feel good about themselves, they feel good about their work, and they forget to edit themselves. They want to share their successes. Just like anybody who gets up in the morning and says, gee, I'm going to go teach a class today, and I had a great class, or, you know, I had a great radio program today, or, you know, whatever it is people feel proud of. So do smugglers.
Yeah. But you and I, let's hope we don't leave people
dead
or injured in the wake of what we're doing to make
a
living.
Here's something about smugglers that I have become really fascinated to try to answer, and it's the most difficult question of all for me. And as somebody who's done this for 20 years, I tend to really become drawn to questions that are very, very difficult. Let me give you an example about smuggling. Now, if you smuggle cocaine or heroin, that's illegal from beginning to end, and it kills people, and there's no question about it. But what if the smuggler, and this is, I've spent a lot of time researching this, what if the smuggler is smuggling critical medical supplies to the front lines and saving lives? Now, it's illegal, it's breaking the law, but they're saving lives. And they're bad smugglers, and people might be putting guns in with those, but actually most trade routes are bombed in a war. Very hard to get your essentials. So while there's really undeniably sleazy people out there selling heroin to kids, and they are just really no question that's bad from beginning to end, how do we begin to think about, how do we make laws, how do we prosecute? And I've done a lot of interviews with judges and courts and police and smugglers. How do we think of people who actually are smuggling essentials?
Hmm.
It's really a tough one, huh?
Yeah, and how do these people who presumably spend a lot of time thinking about these issues, how do they answer the question?
The best answer I got, I was in South Africa, and they have fascinatingly, because they've had such a problem with dealing with crime, started something the rest of us can learn from, an extremely elite group of detectives who try to track crime all the way to the very top, not just the mules and the low-level mm-hmm. people, which usually get busted, but try to have the authority to really find out who the big kingpins are. And they're called the Scorpions, and they're very secret. And I did an interview with one of the main architects of the Scorpions, and basically he said, Carolyn, you know, these are tremendously difficult ethical issues. And all I can tell you is when we sit around and talk with our feet up on the desk, drinking a cup of coffee, we just have to say some things are more illegal than others, and we have to figure out how we rank those.
It's back to being taking a medical perspective, doing triage.
Perfect example. Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely. Oh, that's good. I may steal that. Do you mind? That's very good. It is, because people are bleeding, and it really is life and death. And what will save people and what will harm them more? Yeah.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, anthropologist Carolyn Nordstrom, author of Shadows of War, Violence, Power, and International Profiteering in the 21st Century. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's go back to Sri Lanka, 1983. You report that everyone had a different experience, a different set of images defining what happened. But in the days that followed, you found that the reports of what had happened were inaccurate, or you say at best partial. So how did what was reported square with what had been happening?
This may be the crux of what we need to figure out to help begin mm-hmm. the atrocities of war. Because when you really stand, anywhere I've stood, on the front lines, and as I said, I've done this, you know, on five continents for 20 years, in a lot of war zones. Bombs and guns are fairly indiscriminate. There are a huge range of people, some of them very good, some of them tremendously altruistic, and some of them very bad. And kids, actually right now, I mentioned that children are more likely to be killed than soldiers. They are also tortured in greater number now than soldiers. So there are some severe atrocities that take place, and they are uncomfortable. We don't tend to publish them widely. Who would let this information out? You know, what side would say, yes, we tortured a child? So people spend a great deal of time hiding these kinds of truths. So in fact, women tend to die in numbers as great as men. Non-combatants, civilians, average mom, dad, and the kids, die at a rate of about 9 to 1 to soldiers. 9 civilians to every soldier tend to die in the world today. In the last 100 years, well, in the last 50 years, that's been about pretty average. You see a lot of indiscriminate killing. You see a lot of what we know from Balkans of stories, you know, use of rape as a war strategy, rape camps being set up, tremendous looting, things like this. And these are so outside of our acceptance of war. Who could justify a war anywhere in the world? And this is one thing I found. We tend to say, well, they, in somewhere else in the world, they don't have the same morals we do. Well, in fact, most families anywhere on Earth, I have discovered, and I've lived with a lot of them as an anthropologist, most families honor the same things. They honor integrity, love of family, human rights, sense of democracy. They may not have it, but they understand it, and they tend to cherish these things. So when these kinds of tremendous atrocities take place, we tend to find our stories deleted out. Children being blown up, women, non-combatant men being tortured. And we tend to focus on the soldiers and terrorists, anybody in uniform, things like that. We do a bit of the collateral damage, but the full range of who is really affected is largely deleted. And I've actually had students go through textbooks, you know, go to major bookstores, mm-hmm. both in Europe and in America, and just sit down and say, okay, of these textbooks on war, how many of them discuss, you know, average casualty rates, who's really being killed? I'll walk into my class and I'll say, okay, you guys have 1 week to find out how many children have been killed in Iraq. The statistics just don't exist. They just aren't kept. For whatever reason, we can all guess. I can give you my interpretation. Mm-hmm. Probably just as good. But you literally cannot get a lot of these statistics.
Does it go back to our need for denial?
I think that's about half of it. And I think one of the things I discovered is that there aren't many people out on the front lines who are doing independent research. People tend to be embedded with one side or the other. And if you're embedded with one side, you can't see what's happening on the other side. Nor are you likely to speak too much against your own side. Because there's vested interest, and there's belief, and there's a sense of fighting for something that somebody for the things that people cherish. And so in the sense of just good old independent research, it's much easier in a hospital than a war zone. You just don't tend to find people walking both sides, walking through torture chambers, you know, just plain collecting these statistics. Yeah. And those who are doing it aren't publishing it.
So there are people doing it?
No, I mean the people who are doing the atrocity.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Sorry,
okay, I was like,
aren't speaking to it. They're doing everything they can to hide it. So interestingly, we're finding, like with the Khmer Rouge, with the Nazis, as historically as we're able to go into places where the wars have now ended and actually find the old files, strangely, people tend to document these things somewhere. For some reason, the need to justify atrocity needs people to document it. So they're actually, ultimately, we are finding these things. But in the midst of war, it's very difficult to find this kind of information.
Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar with Clea Coff.
No, tell me.
She's a forensic anthropologist, and she has worked for the UN and human rights organizations going into areas like Rwanda, Bosnia, Croatia, Kosovo. And one of the reasons she does the work that she does is she says you cannot disappear these people, even though they're dead. You killed them. I will find out what happened.
And that just gives me goosebumps. I have such respect for people who do this work because, for me, that can be summed up in one line. They're moving things from the shadows into the light. And when it's in the light, we can all look at it and say, what do we want our world to be? What laws do we want? What kind of humanity are we going to demand?
Yeah.
She's doing something to me that, for me, is incredibly important.
But it has to happen so much after the fact. And in the meantime,
what do we do?
Yeah.
You know, actually, it's really much more simple, I think. I mean, it sounds curious to me to say this, but actually 20 years of research have led me to actually simpler answers than I ever expected. I think what you're doing, you as a radio show host, get conversations going. I have found this is really a curious but wonderful find, and I'm starting two conversations at once, but let me back up for a minute to explain what I'm about to say. I find that most people are good in the world. Few people really do terrible atrocities. Most people really are decent people. They just may not have the time or the knowledge or the wherewithal to be able to make the changes they would like to see. So every time somebody turns on your show and listens to you speak about issues that shape their lives and that make a difference, they start a dialogue. And those dialogues rumble across landscapes of our lives and our societies. And people begin to say, well, wait a minute. I want to vote on this. Or I'm going to write a letter to the editor. Or I'm going to write a song about this. I'm going to paint a painting about it. And it begins to really sort of percolate through the society. And this is how things like the Geneva Convention, support for laws against human rights abuses. You know, speaking of human rights, when I started this work 20 years ago, nobody even used these words. This is just in the last 15, 20 years do we even speak of these things. And it comes from people like you and listeners just saying, wait a minute, what's going on here? We need to do something about this. Mm. That's actually my solution.
Mm. Well, it's like one of the stories in the book is about a man who, forgive me now, I want to call him a cab driver, but I think he had a motorcycle or something, and and things were really terrible, and he looked a little scary, but he was trying to do something good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I ran into so many people like this, but we sort of had this idea. This guy was a really sort of, you know, leather jacket, little scraggly beard, unshaved, you know, tousled hair, cheap clothes, drove these they're three-wheelers, so these really cheap taxis. They're our idea of a thug. You know, we think these are the people who would always profit and be violent and drink too much and beat people up on Friday night. And yet in the middle of this horrible, terrible set of riots, this man is going around trying to save people's lives. And I find that so frequently.
Hmm. We have a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us, so let's go and talk with our first caller, who's on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to turn your conversation a little bit to another direction in the or another part of the world. I know you mentioned Sri Lanka, so but I'd like to go a little more into to Japan and China for one, and then to Iran, Iraq, and ask how much of what you're doing is a product of a Western perspective. And the way I bring that up is examine the some of the activity of the Japanese in Southeast Asia and in China during World War II. A lot of that work was done, let's say, recently, some of it by someone who was actually a Champagne native, Iris Chang, who sadly is killed herself a few weeks ago. She did a work on rape of Nanking. And also the activity of the Chinese in Tibet is another area where it seems to not have generated very much of the kind of work that you're talking about and really examining what's going on there. So I'd like to hear if you have more to say about that. I know Iris Chang at the last was looking at what it was like for American prisoners of war, specifically in the Philippines during the Japanese occupation, maybe also in Japan. And then I'd like you to see if you could address also whether in the Iran-Iraq war, whether the Iranians looked at the war in terms of not just their casualties, but also the casualties to the Iraqis from their, human wave warfare, and vice versa, whether there was any in the Iraqi population, and of course it was all under Saddam Hussein, so that's probably a moot point, but anyone from the Iraqi side looking at, vice versa, the casualties in the Iranian side. So are my questions clear?
Let me make sure with the first question. When you say you're asking about Japan and China, well, Western perspective, did you mean sort of more along the lines of the Western perspective or sort of what was taking place?
No, I'm saying that it seems like Westerners are looking at this, but it seems like the Chinese didn't seem to had limited investigation of that.
Got it. Okay.
And two, the Chinese, certainly in terms of Tibet, have been resisting any investigation of the tremendous atrocities and even genocide that they've been committing during the war against Tibet, their invasion of Tibet, their continued occupation of Tibet. And it's sort of, some of it is trickling out because there are some Tibetans who smuggle it out, and there's some Westerners who've been documenting it. But for the most part, it's, you know, what should I say, word of mouth, but not documented. So that's what I'm saying is that you're looking at it from the point of view of a Westerner with Western values and Western perspectives. I'm saying, and the same Iris Chang looked at it, I'm asking, is it what's happening from the perspective of those societies, whether Chinese in terms of looking at that, Chinese looking at what's going on in Tibet, the Iranians in terms of, well, and the Iraqis. So I'll sort of let you talk about that.
Got it. Okay, that's a really good question because that's something as an anthropologist I'm really curious about. You know, who is looking at what kinds of information? And the reason is, I'm working on a new book, and I literally yesterday just wrote the sentence that the most valuable commodity in the world is information. It's not guns. It's not diamonds. And, of course, because of that, that means it's the most strategic commodity. And you're right. I mean, who is using this commodity of information strategically? What I saw, because I do a lot of traveling to conferences, and in one sense, you've captured, I think, a really important dynamic. It is strategically dangerous to speak of these things. If you're Chinese and you're a citizen of a government, the form of policy is to control Tibet, and serious human rights abuses are taking place, and you speak out against that, you're putting yourself in danger. There's no question about that. And yes, it is really oppressive on some levels to speak about these political issues. And I've spoken with a number of people in China who wonder how they're going to deal with this. Of course, it's exactly what you're saying. During the Second World War, these were things people anthropologists, what we tend to try to look at to find out exactly what you're saying, what Chinese people are speaking out against Tibet? What are they saying? What are the non-official stories? What do people really think? And again, with the Ranarac, it's the same thing. So we turn to things like, believe it or not, music, songs. What songs are people writing? People will put information about dissent into a song that they will not put into a newspaper, because they're much less likely to be killed or caught with a song. Movies. A friend of mine went to Iran and was looking at precisely the question you were talking about. How do sort of the creative artists of society think about exactly your questions? What's going on in the area? What's going on with the war historically with Iraq? What are contemporary relations? And she found that movies were an incredible way to get information that was sensitive. So, yeah, there's a strong official policy to follow the government's, you know, line. But there's always that wonderful sense of dissent. And I think that's why the arts have always been sort of, and we joke about our own country, considered bastions of political hotbeds of, you know, discussion going on, because that's where people are putting the stuff out. And as we saw in a number of wars around the world, some of the first people to be killed are front-range journalists, mm-hmm. artists, leading intellectuals, because that's dangerous. That's where the stuff is, as you said, exactly, trickling out.
Yeah. I want to thank the listener for his questions this afternoon. I've got a number of other folks waiting to talk with us this afternoon, so we're going to go on and see if we can get some more listeners here into the discussion. Next, we go to a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. This is a very solemn but very informative show, and I truly appreciate it. Especially when you're talking about the dissemination of information and so many things, as an anthropologist, I don't know if you've heard the statistic that pregnancy increases the mortality of American women by 50%. In other words, the number of murders doubles if you become pregnant, which just feeds into my topic of domestic violence and violence against women in general, that it's not an information that's really out there. It's a very private crime. It's viewed as a personal crime and not a societal crime. So while you're talking about oppression and atrocities, which is very important, it's a personal issue of mine, and I read Amnesty regularly, and you know they've got their campaign for the violence against women. If you could talk maybe about American oppression and domestic violence, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
You just delved into the shadows and brought something to light that is incredibly important. Those of us doing this kind of research find that anywhere in the world, when political violence rises, domestic violence rises. They're incredibly linked. So that rape, murder, domestic violence are all increasing absolutely hand-in-hand with political violence. And I had an article in a book of mine, The Fieldwork Under Fire, and it was the only article that was written from the American side. Everything else was written from war zones around the world. But one woman said, I was raped in my house one night in America. She's a professor. And she said one out of three women in this country, and we don't even know the statistics on men, speaking of the shadows, but people think it could be as bad. And she said that's a war. You know, if we're allowing this level of violence in our country, if one out of three people in America grows up in a violent household, that's more than just chance. That's more than just biology, because there's nothing in biology that, you know, seems to suggest that one-third of the people are going to be violent and two-thirds aren't. She said this is really in many ways a cultural product in the same way war is. You know, we allow or don't know how to stop certain kinds of violence. But from what you just said, we would predict that domestic violence is rising in America this year because we're engaged in a war. So you are spot on to a really important set of correlations, that it isn't an isolated or a private, domestic violence isn't an isolated or private thing. It really is in some way linked to larger political processes.
I want to thank the listener for his call, and let's take another call. Line three, a listener in Champaign. Good afternoon.
You talked about information as being the most valuable thing, commodity. I'm not quite sure what word you use, most valuable treasure. I was wondering if you might address the question of Fox News, for example, from maybe an anthropological perspective. I was just talking to a friend who was disturbed by his family's reaction to Fox News and the kind of information they get there. And he said, hate is fun. And I don't know whether, I mean, I don't want to hate men or or fraternities or whatever, but there seems to be a certain kind of macho pleasure. Maybe that's not the word. I can't find the word, you know, in this kind of group hate and this, like, refusal to look or to feel the kind of pain that is being inflicted, for example, in various parts of the world with our political policies. And then, of course, you brought up the subject of war, maybe. I don't think you'll have time to talk about Iraq and violence against women or Palestine or Israel. But anyway, I'll just let you go with that about Fox News and hate is fun.
What a great quote. That's fabulous. I try to be really balanced. I learned one thing in Mozambique, which had this, as I mentioned earlier, one of the worst wars in the world. One out of every 12 people is killed in the space of 10 years. And one thing that the people there taught me is to get over war, you have to try to listen quietly to every point of view. And so I try to listen quietly to all the news stations, though it's not necessarily easy because I have my views and I love them as everybody loves their own. But one thing that concerns me in America, I think you've put your finger on, is we've become very entrenched. We're not talking easily across different viewpoints anymore. And this is reflective in like our different news stations. We sort of have polarized, and it concerns me because that's when we lose the ability to solve problems as a nation. And I do think, I mean, in every single war we have documented, there are news agencies that support certain kinds of actions, and they justify them. If a newscaster speaks of hate, and it does happen, and people listen, they find it easier to justify atrocities. And so your question really points out one of the main ways in which human rights violations are justified, and it's through the media, and it's through people saying, hate is okay, violence is okay. You know, if we had to kill that child, oops, we're sorry, but we did it in the greater good. And, well, you know, we need to dialogue these things. You know, we can't just throw that out there. When you just throw it out, it does lead to justifying human rights violations. And by the way, just briefly about your question for Palestine, Iraq, and violence against women, no question. The domestic violence and the sexual violence against women has been rising dramatically. And there's organizations on the ground in all of these countries trying to set up shelters for women, trying to set up solutions for them. But it's a really serious problem. And again, one that's in the shadows, one we don't tend to talk about this.
Yeah. We only have a minute left to go here, and I was going to ask another question, but I think I'll just have to zip it up here. But I do want to ask you, what would you like us to take away from this conversation today, and what do you hope readers of your book will take from it?
I would say the most important thing, and it's taken me 20 years of watching classes of mine feel hopeless in the face of war, that my most important message right now is that, honestly, most people really are good. And most people are out doing what they believe in. It may not be with the best information in the world, but they're not acting out of really malicious intent. And because of that, we really can make changes. We really can make the world a better place. If we kind of look for the good and then don't fear dealing with the bad. So, you know, the bad seems so overwhelming that we almost, as you said, we almost go into denial. But if we recognize how many people are really, really very good, it gives us a better platform to say, okay, well, for those bad people, what can we do to stop the kinds of atrocities taking place? And then realizing, oh, we can make a difference. We can make changes.
Mm. One last question. I thought I was going to stop there, but I want to know, when you talked a little bit with the last caller about listening carefully to points of view that are put across by various camps. How do you look at a news story or stories about a place, a conflict? And I'll have to hold you up here to just a minute, if you can do that. How do you look at a news story? You know, give us some practical advice here for deciphering what we're told about our world in the news media.
The quickest thing I can say, and there's a ton of ways, there's actually classes taught on this, but the quickest way is that if you can accept for a moment what I say, that most people really do share the same values in the world, you think, well, how would you feel if you were under attack? What would you be concerned with? Raising your child, getting food, getting medicine, you know, stopping violence, fighting against, you know, being for balance that with peace. What you would feel if your own home and your own town were under attack is going to be basically what's going on anywhere in the world. People in Iran, Iraq, wherever in the world, are struggling to raise their families and to take care of their communities and try to survive violence in ways we would. So if a newscaster doesn't tap into that sense of real people really living their lives, they're sitting in a five-star hotel, drinking a cold cup of coffee, and following political, you know, scripts, which aren't very realistic. If you look at a news piece, you say, my God, I just imagined myself, my home's under attack, and that's what I'd be doing. Then you know that newscaster's left that five-star hotel, strapped on a flak jacket, walked out, and is talking with people and looking at what's really going on.
There, we'll leave it. Maybe you'll come back and visit with us again some point in the future.
Well, you're wonderful. I would be delighted any time. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
And the next book is?
The next book is all about the globalization of these international profiteering and smuggling systems, the kind of power they're forging in the 21st century and what we do about it.
Very good. Well, we'll talk again. Carolyn Nordstrom has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Notre Dame. We've been talking with her this afternoon about her book, Shadows of War, Violence, Power, and International Profiteering in the 21st Century. The book is published by the University of California. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Well, actually, it's Dave Dickey here at the old desk of agriculture this afternoon. Old Todd went out to the Commodities Conference, Celeste, in Bloomington, and he'll have a feature for us this afternoon during the closing market report.
Well, why don't you tell us then what happened today on the board?
Well, I'll be glad to. We saw very light volume in the soybean pit. That and short covering pushed bean prices significantly higher today. So the Jan settled 7.5 cents higher. The March were 6.5 higher. Let's go ahead and first, though, look at the wheat settlements as we do each day at this time. Going ahead and looking at the December contract, a high on the day of 303.5, a low of $3, settling at $3.5, down 1.5. March, a high of 314, a low of 310.25, settling at 311, down 1. May, a high of 322, a low of 318, settling 318.25, up a quarter. July, a high of 329, a low of 325, settling 325.75, down 1.75. And September wheat, a high of 334, a low of 331, settling 332.5, down 2 on the day. December corn, a high of 198.75, a low of 197.5, settling 198 up a half. March, a high of 209, a low of 207.75, settling 208.25, unchanged on the day. May, a high of 216.25, a low of 215, settling 215.75, up a quarter. July corn, a high of 223.75, a low of 222.5, settling 223.25, unchanged. September, a high of 231.5, a low of 230.75, settling 231 up a quarter. And diesel 5, the red line, a high of 240.75, a low of 239.5, settling 240.25 up a quarter on the day. December oats, a high of 150.75, a low of 149, settling 150.25 unchanged. March, a high of 154, a low of 150.5, settling 152 up 3/4. Then that action in the soybean pit. The January contract, as reported, a high of 562, a low of 553.5, settling 561.25, up 6.75. March, a high of 565, a low of 557, settling 564.5, up 6. May, a high of 570.5, a low of 563.5, settling 570.25, up 6. July, a high of 578, a low of 571, settling 577.25, up 6. August beans, a high of 580, a low of 575, settling 580, up 6. And November 05, a high of 593, a low of 586.5, settling 592.75, up 8 on the day. December soybean meal, a high on the day of 162.80, a low of 160. 10, settling 162.60, up 3.30. January, a high of 164, a low of 161.30, settling 163.90, up 3.30. December bean oil contract, a high of 21.78, a low of 21.50, settling 21.67, down 4. And January, a high of 21.94, a low of 21.63, settling 21.81, down 4 on the day. The settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where rumors surrounding mad cow disease and that the test might either be negative or the cow might be an older cow pushed the live cattle futures higher today, Celeste.
Yeah, and also feeders were higher today as well, although that wouldn't figure in quite so much in the news about mad cow. But let's take a look at these prices. I'm sure Dave will have more on the cattle situation during the closing market report. Prices were higher today across the mercantile exchange in the livestock contract. January feeder cattle 101.15, the high 99.40, the low 99.72 and a half, the settlement that up 20. March 97.35, the high 95.40, the low, the settlement 96.45, that up 95. April 96.50, the high 94.40, the low 95.35, the settlement that up 105. November live cattle 85 even, the high and the low and the settlement, the change there up $1. December 87.65, the high 84.95, the low 87.25, the settlement that up 260. February live cattle 88.60, the high 85.95, the low 87.85, the settlement that up 190. December lean hog 76.20, the high 74.25, the low 76.10, the settlement that up 130. February 74.50, the high 73.40, the low finishing at 74.42 and a half, up 40. April lean hog 71.25, the high 70.52 and a half, the low 70.90, the settlement that down 42 and a half. And May lean hog 70.75, the high 70 even, the low 70.65, the settlement unchanged. And February bellies 101.15, the high 98.50, the low $100.75, the settlement that up 155. The Dow is off 9 points, the NASDAQ off 4, and the S&P 500 down 1 point.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Bob Moore from Silver Lake, California writes, Dear Dr. Science,